Lion Chase. Is this heaven?
Holy moly, donut shop, Lacey Lou, it is now beautiful.
I mean, I feel like I was in heaven recording this episode.
What, the Jaws 2 one with Duncan?
Oh, what do you mean?
That was a great spot. If you guys haven't checked that out yet, please do.
Yeah, on the podcast under the stairs.
Yes, but it's been a while since we've done an episode.
Yeah, I mean, we've had this one on the back burner for a little bit. But, well, they're pre-recorded interviews. So,
yes.
And, I mean, the guys that you're about to hear, I mean, we have from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Harold and Kumar's Christmas.
Richard, like, okay, so even after we did the Richard Reilly interview, I kept seeing him, like, on a different movie.
Yeah.
Like, I saw him in two movies that I didn't even know he was in, and I was just like, my theory is correct.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you're in high school and, like, you pass people every day, and until you actually meet them,
right,
you never noticed them before.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense.
Except Richard Reilly, because that's impossible, because he's in everything
ever. Well, yes.
Yeah.
And you'll hear that in our interview. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, Walking Dead, Office Space. I mean, these guys that we both interviewed, Lou Temple, Devil's Rejects. So many phenomenal movies and TV spots that these guys have been in.
Between the both of them, it's ridiculous.
You know, Buffy the Vampire
Slayer. Oh, man, yeah, I loved it. And here's the thing, too. It's... you got a screener for the movie that they're in called Limbo.
Limbo,
as we were watching it, you know, you always want these screeners to always blow you away, and they don't always do. I will say that we both thoroughly enjoyed this movie
a lot.
And you know, we get excited about these things if we get the opportunity to have, you know, interviews with them. So in this case, get it? In this case, though, we wanted to jump on it, not only because, like you said, you know, we love the movie, but we love these guys' work so much that, yeah, it was just a good time. Not necessarily the normal thing that we do over here at Cut to the Chase, but like I said, I had a blast doing it, and if we have a blast doing something, obviously we want to share it with everyone, so
right,
that's what we're going to do.
And, you know, like we said, this isn't normally something that we do,
right,
but, you know, there is something that we'd like to announce here, you know, Horrorphilia. Thank you to Jason Lloyd for hosting us all these years.
Jason Lloyd's hanging it up, man, and it's kind of sad.
It's been a ride, though.
Yeah, Jason's been great over the years. He's been nothing but awesome in every aspect. You know, I met so many people through, you know, the Horrorphilia Network that you know, I we'd like to call friends, and all
family
of this is because of him, man. Like, he started it all, so thank you so much for everything, Jason Lloyd. And so as he's winding things down at Horrorphilia,
we are actually going to be hosted on another network, thanks to the one and only Taylor Swift loving Philip Perrin.
Phil Perrin himself. So thank you to Phil as well.
And Dark Discussions.
It was pretty much a flawless transition on our part. We didn't have to do anything.
Yeah, so thank you.
Thanks, guys. No, but that's what it's all about, though. I mean, you know, our group of friends, this community, I knew that somebody would carry on Jason's legacy, so to speak, and Phil was the one to take that torch.
Yes, and a lot of actually the podcasts from the network are joining us as well, so you'll be able to check them out on there. So,
yes.
Check it out, guys.
It's official, like a referee with a whistle, ladies and gentlemen.
Now, before we get into our interviews, we're going to do a little mini review of the film.
Yeah.
You'll hear us talk about it quite a bit, but we kind of wanted to get some general thoughts out there. Our real vibe of it.
And right off the bat, we said we loved it, and you'll hear a lot of this in the interviews as well. But, kind of a crazy story. So, do you have the premise?
I do. It is directed and written by Mark Young.
He did a great job.
He did. And this is what kind of drew me to the film itself. The plot alone is something. Obviously, if you follow me on any Letterboxd or Twitter or my Facebook, then you know I'm really into, like, courtroom type settings.
You know she's watched thousands of movies this year.
Well, I'm working on it. So I was really intrigued when this screener came across my lap. And so...
Why do you think you like courtroom dramas? Like, I know why, but I just, like, why do you, what do you think it is?
I think it's you know, not knowing the outcome.
Right.
Like, you never know what's going to happen at a trial.
Right.
And I just think that's one of the coolest premises of, you know, people going, like, you present your case.
Right.
You know, the facts, the evidence.
Yep.
I just think it's really cool. Like, I don't know. I've always been into, like, true crime stuff, too.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, people are like, so you watch a lot of Law and Order. Well, there's actually not a lot of courtroom drama in Law and Order. It's more of, like...
Boom.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it needs more courtroom.
Right.
So, yeah, but...
Yeah.
I don't know. I just really love, like... And, I mean, like, I feel like it provokes more emotion out of me than... I remember reading... Actually, this is probably why. It's To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh.
You know, and that takes a lot of place in, you know...
Right.
A courtroom setting.
Right.
And so that's, like, one of my favorite books of all time. So that's probably where it actually... It was the first book to ever provoke emotion out of me.
Right.
And I just really loved that book, and it had... the whole setting.
And to see the law play out like it does in a courtroom setting, it's so crazy sometimes, you know, the outcome of it. So, like you said, it's an exciting thing, and to see it in different movies and how kind of they put their twist on it, which this one definitely does.
Right.
It's exciting, and, you know, I know...
The anticipation building of not knowing.
Absolutely.
You know, so...
And so accompanied with the courtroom thing, though, you have this other aspect of the plot where it's a fight for a soul between heaven and hell. So that's a whole other aspect.
Right. And it's just a real twist of, you know, how the courtroom setting is. So I absolutely love it. The premise is a murderer finds himself on trial in hell, caught between a bitter prosecutor and an inexperienced defense attorney.
Right.
And, you know, I just thought that was, like, one of the coolest things that's come across to me all year.
Just right from the jump.
Yeah.
Yeah. And see, here's where movies like this can automatically get you, because the setup is intriguing
unique.
Enough. Here's the thing with this movie, too, though, because we've seen setups where we just watched a movie. What should we drop the fucking movie name? What is it? Open 24 Hours,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
So this setup was perfect. We're like, oh, you know, who's it going to be? Who's after this girl?
Like, there's how all this... psychological is this? Is it paranoia? Is it real? What's fake?
Yes, there's backstory. There's all these things where so many places where it could go and develop the plot, you know, and it didn't. It fell flat on its face. Now, in this movie, it took all of the characters different places, and it was really interesting to watch. It was intriguing from the setup alone, but then it got even better as the plot developed. And, you know, I don't even want to call it plot twist, but everything happens the way it does. It was a great movie, I thought.
It's cool, yeah. I mean, I loved from the aspect of, you know, heaven and hell and the in-between. And it's not exactly what you think it is. And it's just a really dope movie. And, you know, it gave me major, like, play-like vibes. And you'll hear the fellas talk about it in our interview. So I don't want to get too into it because... they'll explain it way better than I did, and
you
I don't want to ruin
fellas.
It. The fellas, yeah.
The fellas.
Lou and
the
Richard.
Fellas, the fellas are going out on a camping trip.
But, yeah, we both...
They're going to go film a little movie.
But, yeah, we both really enjoyed this movie, and, check it out, and here's our interviews.
We regret to inform you the show Banjo and Sullivan will be canceled due to COVID-19. But don't you worry, Snugglefucks, we wouldn't leave you in limbo like that. We got somebody to fill in. You know him, you love him from The Walking Dead, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The Devil's Rejects. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cut to the Chase, Lou Temple. Lou, thank you so much for being on the show, man.
Man, Dan, you outdid yourself for that introduction. Thank you. That was very apropos and well knitted together. You've been working on that. That's like a winter scarf. You've been working on that. That's going to serve you well. We're in summer, right? It doesn't have to, maybe a sock.
Yes, yes, indeed. That was a sock indeed. And also, thank you so much for coming on. You know, I've been a big fan of yours for years. You've had such a long career, too.
Yeah, very illustrious.
Yeah, and I first, obviously, like a lot of people, you know, Devil's Rejects, what a great role you had in that. And, you know, this is what I wanted to get into real quick from my perspective as a fan and kind of get into what we do and how it has to do with you personally, actually. You know, through the years, you follow certain actors, and you were always one of them, like I said, from Devil's Rejects, and then even leading into The Walking Dead. You know, that was such an iconic moment, and I was thinking to myself, well, that's iconic for several reasons. One, because Walking Dead kills people off like nothing with no regard, and that's what's shocking about it. But also what was shocking is they killed Lou Temple. At that point, the horror community, I feel like as a whole, you're a legend already, you know? You've had so many great roles that by that point, when they killed Lou Temple, it was more they killed Lou Temple than it was the Walking Dead thing. So I just wanted to say that it's been a joy following not only your career, especially up to this point too, because we'll get into Limbo in a minute, but man, you are at the top of your game right now, sir. I just wanted to say how much of a pleasure it is as a fan and what we do on this side of it, just being able to watch you do what you do.
Well, that's so kind of you to say. Very, very complimentary. I'm humbled. Thank you. And it is, you know, I always feel like specifically the horror genre is such a loyal audience. And it, they're also so passionate. I think those two things go together.
Right.
So it's something that you get when you get off into the genre. And it wasn't something that I set out to do. I wasn't like you, Dan or Lacey. As a child, I wasn't a horror fan per se. I liked movies, but you know, right. They couldn't be typically westerns or the, you know, I liked monster movies, Frankenstein and the Wolfman and Godzilla. But I wasn't as, you know, devout a horror fan as what a lot of people have become. So I didn't know it until, as you mentioned, I got into The Devil's Rejects, and then I was to this incredible world that is so special and so specific, and you know, sometimes you just have a stroke of luck, and I think that's most times. Part of it's luck, and the other part of it is being aware and observant.
Right.
And so for me, that was getting involved with The Devil's Rejects on the front end, and then being exposed to that iconic class of actors, and I'm speaking very specifically about Bill Moseley, very specifically about Ken Foray, very specifically about Sid Haig, God rest his soul, and William Forsythe, and Jeff Lewis. So these guys were veterans, not just of their, you know, career, their acting chops, but they were also veterans of this genre, and they were able to do something that I was observing that I couldn't understand until I was right in scenes with them, and that was very specifically they would push in and encroach on your personal space in such a way, and ever so slightly and ever so subtle, that it really kind of made the whole scene unnerving. And I recognized, oh, this is a skill set that they've developed. This is how the pros of this genre nail it, and so I've always been well aware of that. Bill Moseley spoke very specifically to me about, you know, this is a genre that you're able to build in, and you're not just a vehicle of, you know, someone's story, but you're able to sort of color your story inside of the confines of what's on the page. And so I've always appreciated that. I've experienced and learned that as well. To make a character yours, so to speak. So I got the good fortune of being exposed really early in my career to those cats, and they caught me. And I wish everybody would get that opportunity. So when I go out nowadays, I try with the young guys, I try to give them a little of that same insight. And if they listen, that's cool. If they don't, you know, this is the old guy that's full of crap. So, yeah, thank you. And it's been The Walking Dead was such an incredible experience because it was, it was breaking records on air in the moment. Yeah. Week to week, we were experiencing this incredible popularity. Numbers were saying so. And that thing was very familial. And so everybody was really, unlike anything I've ever done, going on the same side of the rope. There was no hierarchy. There was no prima donnas. Everybody was really working hard to get it done. At that time, we were flying under the radar. So we were doing this without Hollywood executives coming in and telling us this would be good, the paparazzi, the press, and we were really getting to be what we wanted to be. And then, of course, that changes, you know, it becomes so popular. So it's a lot more work now.
Right.
The other thing that was great about that show was that for all the things that are inherently unsettling, like walkers, it was really a show about survival, and it felt like it was, at that time, it was more about economy and more about, you know, how do we pay for college and how do we pay our cell bills, and this is every day we get up to survive. Well, today that means an entire different thing in our current situation, but so I felt like Walking Dead was excellent at nailing, current events.
Right.
So I was fortunate to be on those, those two shows for sure, Devil's Rejects for Raw, and then The Walking Dead. Now, I always tell Rob, I'm like, dude, you should go direct an episode of The Walking Dead.
Right.
I think that would just be perfect. He's got such an audience and a fan base that they would like to see that. And his work is also so good that it would cross over quite easily. But thank you for your kind words.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have, like, any fun behind-the-scenes moments of either The Walking Dead or Devil's Rejects or just working with Rob?
Oh, so many. You know, starting with The Devil's Rejects, we were at the table read, and this is just something, again, it felt like the Super Bowl, and these guys came in, Foray and Forsythe and Sid Haig and Bill Moseley, and all of a sudden there are reads at a table, which are typically you're kind of finding your way, kind of stumbling through it. And these guys were bang! It was crack-a-lackin'. And it was so, oh man, it was scary just to hear them read it, and it brought your game up. And I was like, oh man, I better bring some firewood. This is good. This is for real. So that was fun. And then I got to spend a lot of time, of course, with Jeffrey Lewis, who played my partner, Roy Sullivan.
Yep.
He's passed now, too, God rest his soul. But he always had these tidbits of incredible information that seems so silly, but if you put your head to it, you go, that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So the very first thing he did was like, hey, I'm Jeffrey Lewis. And he hands me a card, and I look at it, and it says, Clint Eastwood's best friend. And I'm like, wow. But then I realized, wow, you did all those movies with Clint. You probably are.
Right.
And so Every Which Way But Loose and all those Hang 'Em High. And then one time we were walking and talking, he said, you know, when you go in to do a scene, always put your hand on the lead's shoulder when you're talking to him. That way you can't get cut out of the movie because your hand's there. This is beautiful, you know.
That
so
is.
Beautiful. Those kinds of things. Or, you know, Rob Zombie asked me in the hotel scene, when Vimes was saying Jimmy gets executed, he said, what's in the reaction? You know, what? How do you guys, you just want to tremble with fear? And I'm like, I don't know, Rob. I might lose my lunch.
Right.
Perfect. And next thing I know, there's this, you know, Campbell's chunky clam chowder being put in front of me to, it, you know, ingest so that I can have something to projectile. And we did that take after take. It was terrible. Or one final behind the scenes on Devil's Rejects, Lexi, is that in the scene with Otis, and he cut my face off, of course, that's Bill Moseley, and it was hot. We did this for 2 days, and we were out in Palmdale, California, really hot desert. And they were pumping so much blood in through my neck in the scene. It was in my eyes. It was everywhere. And I was really frustrated. And Bill was really frustrated. And I kept spitting this blood in his face. And it would get all over his hair, which means that he'd have to take time with makeup to clean it out of his hair so it would be clean the next take. And he was so pissed at me. And it just made the scene that agitation. It kind of made it work. It was kind of great.
I mean, you just talked about iconic scenes, and I'm just looking at through such a different perspective now. But yeah, like you, the way that you're describing it, like it's like wow, like literally, you see that on that picture of Otis with the blood on him. It's just so iconic.
Yeah, and you could just know he's so furious with right there. Like, well, if you keep putting this spit in it, we're going to be here all day doing this because it's going to take all day to clean it out of my hair.
That's a pretty good impression, too.
Yeah, right? That was it.
So he was not far from jabbing that knife through my throat, I can tell you. You know, The Walking Dead, on season 3, we were doing... It was great to show up then because they had been at Herschel's farm and it had been kind of inclusive. They hadn't really ventured out.
Right.
So when they showed up at the prison, we were from new blood, fresh meat, you know, new faces, and the audience was thrilled to see that. And so those were all fun things. Also back then, all roads led to Sheriff Rick Grimes, you know, Andrew Lincoln's character. It was all about his storyline and how he was dealing with things, and that was actually a lot of fun. Today, there's many storylines, as you well know.
Yes.
You know, from Negan to Judas, you know, to Whispers, to you know, all manner. That thing just opened up right after they left the prison. And so, Andrew was doing a lot of heavy lifting. I'm talking about Andy Lincoln, Lincoln, the actor that plays Rick Grimes. And, you know, because everything was just filtered through him. So it was a lot of work. This guy is a tireless worker. I mean, he's the Tom Brady of that. And so we would try to kind of lighten it up. Like occasionally we'd switch costumes, you know, and show up at the scene, and I'd have Daryl's wings on or whatever, you know. Or there were times we'd wear sombreros we'd walk in to a scene with sombreros or big mustaches, although I didn't need one. But and Andy would break up for just a second, but then he'd get right back into the focus, so... and then, of course, Norman is renowned, Norman Reedus, for his practical jokes. And there were all manner of practical jokes being played, typically by him. And, you know, it was always, you know, a lot of fun. And then, but the fun was able to sort of dissipate how hard the work was. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of work, make no mistake.
Right. Well, and now that was such an iconic moment, and you have so many throughout so many films. I feel like one of our favorites of that year, I just wanted to say, was The Endless. The Endless was amazing.
Yeah.
And it was so good because here's one of I'd say this is probably a subject that not a lot of people, I don't know, I guess talk enough about, but, and I don't want to call it a trope, but with what The Endless did with the first film
Resolution
and how they
intertwined
the connectivity to it. You know, like, we just did our show on the Back to the Future trilogy. You know, I'm a sucker for time travel, stuff like that. Like,
just
all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'll even tie it into something like a revisionist history with what Tarantino did with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know? And these great ideas, and it just seems like, I don't know, is that something that you're attracted to when you read it? Is that
absolutely. I think it comes from, because what you're speaking to is something that is very specific to what I'm searching for, and it's not just me. I think we all innately have this search, and I think it has to do, I suspect, with our imagination. Mm-hmm. And I think we get off into our imagination, and we wonder, we hand ourselves over to the what if so often, and we consider the possibility of the what if, and then it becomes a probability. Yeah, of course that would make sense. Of course there's the opportunity to ascend, return better, you know, and mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I think people that allow themselves not just to build their imagination, but to be inspired by their imagination, but also to receive with their imagination. So oftentimes when I get a script, I will read a script and this can be a bit of a trap. I will let my imagination start working, mm-hmm. and in my head there's a movie being built that has nothing to do with what I'm reading on the page. Sometimes I'll show up on set, and the director will be like, "That is a really cool idea, but we are not making that." That, you know, and I'll have to go, "Oh shit! Wow! Oh no!" Maybe you should recast because I showed up to see this movie. Okay, but yeah, I love The Endless. The boys came over, mm-hmm. Introduced themselves. They came to my house, which was such a polite and proper thing to do, and they sat down, and I had read the script, and I was impressed with it. And the role wasn't built on the page with so much red herring, you know, we didn't really see on the page where it was going, and they weren't certain either. Mm-hmm. And so we all discussed it a little bit, and we recognized that the character would be, Tim would be very sage and wise, and maybe potentially either the problem. You kept looking for my character, Tim, to come, you know, be the guy that's going to do something drastic. Right. And he never really is, other than a few tidbits of wisdom. We built him after John Muir, the environmentalist that started the parks. Yeah, with the big beard. And so,
yep.
That was really who we were trying to model him after. I adored the work of just kind of being there, being present, and, you know, making the most of very little dialogue.
Right.
And just actually enjoying the young guys, Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson, work and build, not just from a script they had written and cinematically building it, but they were the stars of the film, so they were actually working in front of us and needing to perform, mm-hmm. which was a huge task. And I think that movie has turned out so great. And I applaud you both for reviewing it and putting it on your list. Now, I hold it up there with something like Primer. Did you guys ever...
Oh, my God, man. Primer, yes. It kind of... It's so simple, the way they explain time travel, and it's just... That's a beautiful movie. I love that movie.
Yeah. So I think these boys are right in that pocket with Shane.
Yep.
I think they're entirely friendly. I think they cross-pollinate with friends. You know, the other thing about these two filmmakers, Justin and Aaron, they're huge film cinephiles. They go to festivals, they go to movies, they look at movies, they love films, they talk to everybody about movies.
Right.
And they're very genuine. They're not, you know, trying to outdo anyone. They do what they do very well, and they love what everyone else does. If they could spend their careers just attending film festivals, I think they'd be more than happy.
Yeah.
I love hearing that. Like,
yeah.
it's so great to hear when, you know, you have positive experiences with people, and especially when you're a fan of a film, and to know, like, it was such a great experience.
Yeah.
I just love hearing that.
They're the young breed, so, you know, that's important. So, you know, you start to recognize the change of, you know... So look, in some place, I've had really great fortune to work with what I call the Lions, and those guys are people like Tony Scott, people like Gore Verbinski, you know, people like Quentin Tarantino, like Rob Zombie, and then what's happening, we transform from the old Lions to some of the new Lions, and I hold these two boys, Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, is two of the young Lions that are on the come.
Yes.
That's awesome. You know, actually, that was going to be one of our questions is, you know, you've worked with, you know, quite prominent directors in the industry, and one being, we already spoke about Rob Zombie. I kind of want to just ask you about Quentin Tarantino for a second.
Oh, no.
I think this kid's got some legs. Yeah, he might hang around. That was such an incredible experience. Now, it starts with just being kind of selected and invited because he had known my work, like you.
Dude, he mentions you on the commentary. Like, I remember him talking about you on an audio commentary he was doing with somebody one time, and I'm like, yes! I'm like, of course he's a Luke Temple fan.
he was so effusive, just like you, and so that's, you know, it's so sweet, and it's so, you know, there's a kind of validation there. So you get invited to be part of the team. And then you show up, and it's like being invited to the All-Star team, you know? And
yep.
So you're there at the NBA All-Star game, and, you know, you got your brand-new sneakers on, and, you know, Nike made this for you for this game. So. But there's a lot of really great players, let's be honest.
Right.
You know, there's DiCaprio, and this Pitt, and this Pacino, and, you know, this the Kurt Russell, and... You know, Margot Robbie, and you got it. So there's not a lot of game time.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So you're kind of sitting on the bench a lot, which can be a little unsettling because you're typically not riding the pine that much. But being an observer, being somebody that's aware, you have a great opportunity to watch this master named Quentin Tarantino who's running this set. And you recognize, oh, wow, this is what he does and why it's so good.
Right.
And he is just a storyteller. So not just a storyteller on his page or in his camera, but in between takes, he has a story for everything that comes up.
Yeah.
If a bird flies by, he's got a story about a bird flies by one time. And a man got killed.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's crazy. He is a storytelling machine, and he enjoys it, and there's so much passion and so much energy. I mean, the energy is huge, and so that energy is what he brings to that his world, and it's the engine. He's like the sun, and so you just feed off of that, and it takes a certain you have to kind of give in and go with that flow. Like,
right.
If you're somebody that's rather insular and, you know, subtle, it's not going to be real comfortable. You're going to have to find your comfort zone. But if you're an outgoing, gregarious person to get engaged in the heat of that sun, it's really works really well. And so I was very happy to be there and see him. And he is he's the director of his set, regardless. I mean, Mr. Pacino showed up. I saw him work one day, and, you know, it's Al Pacino. He's going to do what he's going to do. And it's pretty, it's pretty big and it's pretty amazing. So you don't really get in the way with that. But I did watch like Leonardo DiCaprio really just get directed by Quentin Tarantino, no question. Or Brad Pitt really just gets over their vehicle to be directed. And that's really interesting to see, you know. And it's interesting to watch Quentin's process. Because, and here's the other thing. As an actor on set, you have to be ready. Yep. He carries this yellow notepad, so he can scribble out a monologue in the moment.
Oh, wow.
And then just say, hey, can you read my handwriting? I want you to do this monologue right now. Wow. You know, it's not like, and if you say, oh, let me go back to my trade for this work on this, then that moment's gone. No. So you have to be kind of on point and ready to rock. And I think that type of awareness, anxiousness, that keeps it fresh, man. It keeps it alive. And so he was amazing. He was entirely amazing.
I definitely love hearing that kind of artistry. Now, I kind of want to get into, you know, we just watched the new film, your new film, Limbo, coming out.
Great. Yeah, man. It seems, I'm trying to reference the idea that we're kind of living in limbo.
Right.
I mean, if art imitates life, sadly, when the pandemic broke out, I got asked to speak a lot about being on The Walking Dead and what was that like. And it felt like, oh, well, yeah, that's strange. I lived in this world that there was a virus, and we had to deal with it. And then, and now I've got this movie Limbo, and I feel like we're a little bit in purgatory with our, our numbers. Spiking here and there, and we don't know when the vaccine is coming and these kinds of things. But what I love about Limbo very specifically is the twist, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
And, the twist at the end and the idea of redemption. But even more than that, just going in without giving anything away, I love the idea of a courtroom drama based on your soul.
Right.
Drawing men of your soul. You're going to heaven or you're going to hell, and we're going to take that to court and work it out.
Right.
And, and I just find that, you know, kind of delicious. And so
the synopsis really does draw you into the film, even before seeing it. So I was...
Yeah.
Well, and it almost, when we were watching it, and there are times that they go away from this room, but it's all in one room, and it really is kind of like a play, you know?
It is.
It seems
it
like
is.
That.
That's a good point. Very astute of you, man, because it did. And so that was the challenge, as you can understand. So the challenge is to not just be three talking heads in a room, but to be compelling about what's being exchanged, and then to give the room a certain dynamic and movement even when we're there. And so that puts the burden on us as performers, but even more so on the cinematographer Christos, who was, I thought, just lensed it gorgeous. And Mark Young, who is the writer and the director, his shot compositions, his decisions on how to shoot, and then editing and cutting. So it just kind of gives the room some movement. I can remember on set us talking a lot about, well, we've kind of been in this corner before. We've buried this corner. So you'll see times that I very specifically get up and walk around and try to give the room a little more space, a little bit different of a look in it. And that was important because of what you just referenced. We didn't want to just get stuck as, three talking heads in the room. And then Mark had always had some ideas about breaking it up, but in doing in doing so, when I say breaking it up, going outside of the room to, uh-huh. to life,
yep.
He really understood how important that was, mm-hmm. When we actually went out on the streets to kind of give it the real world and
right.
then come into our otherly world back in the interrogation room, which was really, really a challenge, no doubt. But I'm really happy and proud of what we were able to off.
Well, I was particularly happy too because, like I said, I'm a big fan of your work. I'm also a huge fan of Richard Reilly as well. And there's a scene, man, in the beginning of this movie. It's like when you guys are talking, and it just hit me. I'm like, yes. I'm like, this is fucking great because, like, it's just
the emotional moment.
Yeah, and like I said, I've been such a fan of yours and his for so long, but it's such a great movie too. You guys were so dialed into it that, I don't know, for a movie fan, that
really
was a dream come true.
With him, I have to say, because Richard is so likable.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I'm sitting there not very optimistic, and he has no reason to have any hope, and that's all he has.
Right.
And you know, he's talking about going to Disney World, you know, and
none jokes.
I'm like, and I'm saying what, you know, a shithole L.A. is, you know, and so I felt like that was really a sensitive scene and so delightful because of the juxtaposition of these two guys, but he got to me there, you know, he did get to me.
Right.
And so, and I thought that was important, too, to show this guy could be gotten to, and Richard was so good. And keep in mind, he's sitting there with horns on. By the way, I mean, you know, when these guys first came in with their prosthetics, I'm like, what? You know, Billy Goat Gruff? Are we doing that movie? I mean, but at some point, Jerry Constantine, who was our special effects makeup, he made them. They're very real, but they're not overbearing.
It looked like they hurt.
It did look like it hurt. Yeah, yeah. I was happy not to wear those. You know, I was happy I didn't. So yeah, I've adored him too, and he's got, as I said, he's so endearing and he's so lovely. Everybody, now getting to these performances, everybody brought a really great performance, and what's good about any performance is arcs, and in the small this is what makes The Devil's Reject so good, is because all of the characters have life in front of us in even a very small time. Even the chicken fucker guy,
you know,
in Limbo, yeah, all of the characters have a life. So, and then to work with Veronica Cartwright and to let her play that life all the way through was really, really just such a joy and such a gift for me. And so we go from, Scotty Thompson, who's, you know, just holding up this thing, angelic quality, kind of very cold, and then, trying to put on a good facade to... Mark cast Lucian Collier, who plays Balthazar, the young guy.
Yeah.
That was built for an older guy. Mm-hmm. So there was a point in time where we were like, well, Richard would be really great for this guy.
Right.
Wow.
And even there was a time where I was like, I think I sort of want to do Balthazar, you know?
Yeah.
But Mark very wisely went against the grain, so he's going to put this old guy in a young guy's vintage, young guy's aesthetic, and put this old soul, and I think it just works perfect.
I'm so
happy with that. Yeah,
I thought it was portrayed really well because, you know, it's like that was how he obviously probably passed away.
It's kind of creepy, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I kind of read it, and, you know, it's this kid who had this whole life ahead of him, and you know, but he's been doing this for so long.
Yeah, that's what's great, you know, when he speaks about thousands of years, and you know, in his he's really at odds with his father at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know, he's got a certain teen angst to him, which is, you know, kind of really, really rich in the character. So I really appreciated that as well. And the guy that comes in, Andrew Miller, to play my father, Andrew Elvis Miller, he's so great. You know, he's building such character in such a short time. And again, everybody did in this scenario. And then to have James Purefoy come in at the end.
Oh, that was great.
And, yeah.
And just, you know, chew it up with sort of, you know, Southern George W. Bush Satan, you know?
Right.
I think, you know, he can do nails.
You do really good impressions.
I mean, yeah, he is good.
It was a lot of fun. And then Peter Jacobson, so, you know, you've got the second in command, which is so typical of these things. You know, you've got the front guy, and he's not as bad. It's always this guy behind the scenes. And so Peter's playing this Belial character, this you know, number two, trying to get things done. He's just angry the whole time. Peter's particularly good at spitting out dialogue very quickly and very poignantly. And so I just really enjoyed watching him. So the movie for me is it's more of a psychological drama.
Okay? Right.
And I feel like, well, it fits in the horror genre. It could also cross over. So I'm pleased with it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of anything like courtroom. Like,
yeah.
This is definitely my jam. And I love the, you know, the internal conflict of, you know, like you have like no hope in the, you know, in everyday life. And then, you know, after, and you can see your character getting more hope as the movie goes on.
Yeah.
And so it was really unique to see that as, you know, somebody who has no hope as living but has more hope dead.
Yeah.
It was actually really kind of cool to see. Was that hard to convey?
Yeah, it was, because we had just about based on how we shot it and the chronological. So we never left the room. We shot out the studio.
Oh,
so
wow.
I hadn't had the experiences yet that I was going to go have
right.
in real life. So I had to build all those memories of what happened or, you know, what was on the page before they actually happened. So I hadn't shot anyone, and I hadn't, you know, had that experience with Veronica. It's very typical of movies, really, again, getting back to our imaginations and what we have to do as performers so much is to build that work. So letting go of the real world and getting into this kind of ether world of limbo, and then making a change, you know, waking up not knowing where I was,
right.
to be frustrated and angry, to being confused, to being, okay, let me get this straight, and disbelief and bewilderment, to being, I can't fathom any of this, to, okay, this might work. Yeah, these were all marks that I had to sort of be very specific. Here's a turning point, and here's where I'm going to change, you know. What was hard for me was that the guy that I knew he was in the real world was violent, and it was hard not to be violent in the room.
Right.
Right.
And not, it was hard for me not to resist the urge to grab Balthazar and shake him and say, let me go, I'll tear you, it's hard for me not to hit and to be restrained, interestingly.
Yeah. There you go.
Right.
But I also feel like that is what's good about it, because,
yep.
you know, it's going to be, everyone's going to ask, well, why didn't he just fight his way out of there? Why didn't he force his way out of there? That's what guys like that do.
Right.
Probably, but maybe not in maybe that's not what they get to do in purgatory. And then there was one other place that I tried to land that. It's very interesting, of restraint. And that's when the pimp is kind of letting me know about how things are. And it looks like there's going to be this physical encounter.
Mm-hmm.
That, so I wanted it to have this heightened tension and then not be able to do anything.
Right.
For whatever reason. All that stuff is very nuanced. And that's what I would also say about the film. There's just some subtlety to it that I think is really rich in performances and also in the filmmaking itself with the cameras.
Right, absolutely. And you know, I hate to even call them twists. It's just the plot. It's the story. And it does take so many turns. And it's so well done. And we commend you on it. It's very well balanced. And honestly, man, you knocked your performance out of the park. Everything that you were talking about, especially when your parents showed up and everything too and all that, everything was conveyed perfectly, man. So, well done.
And, you know, with it being 2020 and, you know, not being able to go to the movies and to be able to get a new movie, this one was honestly such a treat. So, thank you. Everybody can see this.
I'm excited as well. I really want folks to be able to see it because I think it's always great to think when you're seeing something or be asked to participate in intellectual response with anything that you're doing. I don't mind just taking a ride on an action flick. I think those too.
Right,
but
right.
I think ultimately I get back to that marketing, you know, it's called fishing, right? It's not called catching. So we're looking, we're seeking. And so I think these kind of movies tempt us. They tickle our imagination. They tickle our intellectual curiosity, and we go forward. And so I want people to see this. It comes out the 4th of August, I think.
Yep.
And it's available on iTunes, and I think you can buy it physically on DVD. But I'd love for it to get on a streaming platform where everyone see it. So I'm sure it will be. I'm not sure where that is, but definitely starting off with iTunes.
Yeah, I know everybody's excited for it. I've talked to a lot of people. There's definitely some buzz about it for sure, man.
Great.
And you know what? And it lives up to the hype. You know, at the end of the day, it's a great movie.
It's fun. It's dramatic. It's emotional.
It was.
And I just got to ask you one more question to close this out.
Yeah, for sure.
What is your favorite horror movie?
A great question, and I'm glad that I announced it before, because and the answer hasn't changed. Interesting, it's Rosemary's Baby.
Okay, wow, heavy hitter.
And so after this conversation, I think you'll go, yeah, that makes sense.
Yep, it does.
There's something about the subtlety of it, the creepiness of it. I think there's some hidden, you know, hidden inferences to it. It's all about, did I just see that? Is this what I think it is? What's behind there? Well, you know, are they not who they really seem to be? Is she aware of any of this? Oh my God, is he part of it too? You know, all of those things are the psychological tear as opposed to, you know, clear and present danger and physicality, but
right.
I love the mental aspect of that.
That's
and so,
so cool.
I appreciate those movies. I appreciate all of, you know, the great, you know, horror movies for sure. But if you can dangle a little psychological warfare in there,
right?
I'm in.
Yep, I'm the same way.
Rosemary's Baby, thank you for asking.
Yeah, well, thank you for letting us pick your brain for about an hour here. We definitely appreciate you taking the time. I hope you have a great week ahead of yourself.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm in limbo.
We feel you.
I'm in limbo all week, that's for sure. Thanks so much for having me, and I've enjoyed, you know, being on Cut for the Chase and lacing up with Lacey. Yeah, there we go.
Lou, you're the man.
And you have a wonderful week as well. Thanks so much for not just having me, but also for having Limbo.
Absolutely.
For giving it a look and a ride and being responsive to it.
Well, the pleasure was all on the side. Believe me. This is I've been dying to do this interview all week. I've been so excited. So thank you so much, man. We really do appreciate you.
All right. Take care, man.
You too.
All right, man.
Bye.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is my honor and privilege to finally introduce one of my favorite actors of all time, Richard Reilly. Thank you so much for being on the show, sir.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, one of the first shows that we actually did for Cut to the Chase was A Very Harold and Kumar Christmas. One of my favorite Christmas movies of all time, mind you. can you talk a little bit about that experience first? Because first of all, the best Santa of all time just nailed it. And yeah, can you talk a little bit about that experience?
I'd be happy to. It was wonderful. Yeah, we were in the Detroit area. We shot up a lot of it in Hamtramck. In what had been I think a Ford plant, but no, Whippy. And so they, we made it into most of the stuff. And then the house where was in Bloomington, a suburb of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And we, of course, as you do most Christmas movies, we shot it in July. So it was all, we were wearing sweaters and you know, all fake snow and stuff, and the neighbors couldn't figure out what was going on. But it was just a delight to work on. John and Cal were just amazing, and we just, you know, we just had a great time. It was a wonderful script. There were a lot of good people, and we just had a blast. I especially loved the final scene where they had to teach me how to use one of them. And I wasn't sure what one you're supposed to pull the little thing out to get the smoke in.
Right.
But I learned pretty quickly.
what a great place to learn too from those guys. The writers went on to do Cobra Kai too. They're huge, and yeah, and they spoke very highly about you. I've seen in a lot of interviews. Actually, every interview I've ever seen anybody talk about you, sir, they've always had the nicest things to say about you. Over the years, you've had so many different, not only just roles, you know, iconic roles. Man, I have to mention Office Space.
Right.
Just one of the like, it never gets old. We still watch that. You know, I watched it as a teenager. Now I'm 35. I still watch it. We still crack up. Do you remember how that was working on that?
With Mike.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
Mike had spent a long time casting it. I think I was in like three or four times. First time I went in, I read both for the psychiatrist and for Tom Smarkowski. And then toward the end, I was just reading for Tom, and that was great. And he was wonderful. And eventually, when he put the cast together, and a big part was of his casting process was making sure he had a group of people that would have a good time hanging out, because that's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Austin for a month, and he said, "This is my hometown. We'll work hard, but at night I'll take you to the best place to see eat." The clubs were where my band used to play, and that's exactly what it was like. And we kind of everybody was kind of there all the time, and that was part of the joy of it, and the writing was great, and so everybody had a good time. I remember when the first time we had the Bobs in, they were terrific, but they both come from improvisational stuff, and so they said, "Mike, is it okay if we improvise a little bit?" And he said, "Sure." So for about half an hour, they did some, they improvised their questioning of me. I was the first guy that they had, and it was fun. We had a great time, and then they said, "Okay, let's do it the way I wrote it." And that's what we ended up doing it, because he had written this brilliant stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, you know, over the years, like I said, so many iconic roles. One of the main movies where it finally hit me, though, I was like, wow, this guy is in everything, was the Texas Chainsaw 3D. And I was like, oh my God, he's in this too. I was like, what a great world we live in where Richard really is in literally everything. From that point on, though, I was like, okay, once we got to Chillerama, and this is the one I really want to know about because you had a pretty prominent role in that. You know, one of my favorite wraparound stories of any anthology ever. And you brought so much magic to that and, you know, talking about the magic of the movies and all of that kind of stuff. Can you talk about your experience working on that?
Yeah, that was great. We shot in the City of Industry an actual working drive-in, and so we had it was a four screen drive-in. We had one of the screens, so we would get there, and meanwhile on the other three screens there were shows showing and people coming and going, and that was terrific. They had each episode had its own director.
Yep.
But there was one night when they were. I can't remember, for some reason we had to be out of there early, and so I had all four directors who were working simultaneously, and so I would go from one spot to the other to do, you know, to be shot someplace or to get my weaponry out of the behind the ocean wells.
Yeah.
It was just terrific, and we had to shoot between 1 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the all the scenes that were shot in the projection booth.
Yep.
because normally it was working, and that was the only time when it was shot down, and so we would, as soon as the shows were done, we would run up there and shoot whatever we were going to shoot there, and it was absolute madness. We had such a great time doing it. I can't begin to tell you. and Joe was pretty much responsible for the wraparound part.
Yep.
And then Adam Green, who I had done my very first genre film with, Hatchet.
Yes.
Yeah. And there were a number. All of the directors. It was great to meet them and work with them. And they had some terrific actors working on that too. It was just amazing. And I loved all the lines that they'd come up with that I would, you know, that from the movies that I would quote as I was shooting somebody.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you have a lot of great lines in a lot of movies, the new one especially too, but we'll get to that in a second. But in terms of Chillerama, I wanted to get your take on, you know, the movie business as of right now. You know, we saw your latest movie and it was basically one of the only newer ones that have come out recently. You know, we got it for review. It doesn't come out for an extra, couple weeks, but still there's been nothing coming out obviously because of COVID. What do you think about them opening back up the drive-in and trying different things? I mean, what do you do in these times?
Yeah, I think the drive-in is a great idea. I'm worried about when they're going to finally be able to open up indoor theaters. There's so much that goes into having to protect the audience and coming to see that. Where the drive-in, it's a little bit easier. And I always enjoyed drive-ins. I went to drive-ins when I was a kid a lot.
Nice.
And so they're just a fun way to see a movie. A movie where you have to concentrate and it's that serious, maybe is not something that you would necessarily want to see in a drive-in. But there's so many films that are great fun to watch out there.
Yeah.
I'm anxious to know when we're going to be able to open up and start shooting again. That's been a difficult thing as well.
Right.
Well, I was going to ask you: have you did you have any shoots lined up that got canceled, or has it? I mean, I'm assuming.
Yeah, there were a number of them. It was funny because I had uh, I, I, there were I was supposed to go and shoot something, and they canceled it when they shut everything down. And then about a month later, as they began opening things up slowly, a month, maybe 6 weeks later, I began getting inquiries. I would get a script saying, does this, script and a role interest you, and would you come and do it if we could do it? And I said, sure. But most of them, as it turned out, most of them were planning on shooting in Texas.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so that sort of eliminated a lot of those. I haven't heard any more from those people. And the only other one that was a really lovely kind of coming-of-age, Our Town-ish movie that they were going to shoot in Virginia. And it got that, first they pushed it a month. Then they said, okay, we're going to try to do it in September. And then about a week later, I got a call from them saying, I don't think we can do it in September. Let's aim for May 2021. So I think that's where we're at right now.
Right, right.
Well, it's really cool to hear, you speak about your career, and I mean, you've also did Broadway, right?
Yeah, I was really fortunate. I did three shows on Broadway. I spent 10 years in New York.
Wow.
And I really enjoyed that. Now I don't, because everything is so shut down there. But
yeah.
there were many years after I came out here where I really was trying to get back to New York. The first Broadway show I did was Execution of Justice. It was about the shootings of Governor Moscone and Harvey Milk, and it was a really interesting piece. It opened up a theater on 52nd Street, which they hadn't gone that far north yet, Broadway. Which at that time they called it the Virginia, then it was the Canta Theater, then it was the Jew Jamison, and I think now it's the August Wilson Theater. But it was still doing shows before everything shut down. Then I did Iceland Comet in 1999, I think it was. And then in 2001, right after, we were one of the first shows that opened after, actually, I guess you opened in 2002, but after 9/11, and it was a Arthur Miller play called The Man Who Had All the Luck. It was his first play, and it ran for 4 days in 1949, I guess. And he was still around. He came and watched the rehearsals and talked to us, and that was really exciting as well.
Nice.
Yeah, no, I always just think it's really cool when, actors can, show an extension of themselves and be versatile and do Broadway, plays, theater. And you mentioned Our Town, so I had to bring it back up. So thank you for sharing.
Well, Richard really is a legend, baby.
Well, he's in everything.
What
and
do you
so
mean?
I let Dan fanboy it out for a minute. So I have to fangirl it now.
There's tape over my mouth. Sorry. Go ahead.
One thing right before we get into Limbo, one thing I noticed about your character in it was the horns. And the horns actually, it made me think of this whole other world, that Joss Whedon created with, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes.
And
yeah.
And you actually, what's kind of cool about your character is, it was played by Donald Sutherland in the movie, and then in the show you got to play Merrick, Buffy's first watcher. So, and your character is actually in the graphic novels as well. So I thought that.
I know. I was really surprised when I saw that. Yeah, it was at the end of the first. I can't remember the end of which season it was. It was the last
two.
It was season two. Episode 21, I think, Becoming.
Yeah, we're big Buffy fans too.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's great. I loved it too. I watched Buffy why is my mind going on? But the thing was is that I came in and auditioned for it, and yep. I met with Josh. He was directing that episode.
Mm.
And so we talked. And when we were talking, I got the impression that he was going to sort of bring this character back,
right,
in a way, at least in some flashbacks. But then it went a entirely different way over the summer, as things often do. But it was a wonderful experience. We just had such a great time working on that, both well, a lot of shoots usually are at night, as you can imagine, with Fluffy.
Right.
But well, we had a couple of afternoon shots at the school, which were very fun, and kind of made people you know, they had to, but by that time there were so many fans that they had to really block off the area so that they could bring the buses in to, you know, to do the stuff. But everybody was so wonderful on that show. I mean, both the actors, and Josh was incredible.
That I'm like speechless. I'm like, yes, please talk more about Buffy. no, but we actually brought you here to speak about your latest film, Limbo. Like Dan was saying, there's not a whole lot of content coming out right now because of the times we're living in. So this was, you know, a real treat for us, and we thoroughly enjoyed it. And the concept of it, you know, it's kind of a courtroom,
so
heaven and hell drama. Is that what drew you to the script?
What was interesting was when I got the script and read it, I found it, you know, just an exciting, interesting story about these, you know, about these people, and it with so many twists.
Yeah.
You know, when his parents show up, when, you know, blah blah blah, blah. And I don't want to do it anyway. when we shot it someplace way south of downtown LA. I can't remember what I think Vernon or some old town there. And it was like going to hell every morning.
Oh, wow.
and we there was this you know, on the freeway there, and it was a little industrial park, and there were nothing but huge trucks there going back and forth, and we had to kind of work our way in there and find a place to park. And where we shot, actually, I think had been a tire store there, and they did an amazing job of creating the courtroom and also the bar, the demon bar.
Mm-hmm.
And just speaking of horns, I was so upset that I didn't get to be in the demon bar, but they needed my horns for one of the demons.
Oh, so it was your exact horns that the other demon was wearing?
Well, I didn't know who eventually ended up with my horns, so they said, yeah, we can't have in the demon bar because we need the horns for all these extra demons.
Yeah, no, and that's definitely what was reminiscent to me of, you know, Angel and Buffy was the horns. Did it take
I'm sorry,
that was the other one. Right. Yeah.
Did it take a long time to get those put on?
Yeah, they got quicker, but it's a whole process because they have to really stick there, so they have to create sort of a base in which they can put the horns, and it takes about. I think we got it down to like about 40 minutes from the time you got into the chair to you were all done and horned up and made up and ready to go.
Yeah, and you said the twist too. You know, the plot of this movie is so smart, and you know, like I said, I'm a big fan of yours, so it was great seeing it. One of the most entertaining stenographers of all time, I would probably say. You could add that to you.
The exciting part about it, I got to watch everybody's performance.
Yeah,
I mean, there were so many wonderful actors in. There, and I watched them at each as they came in and did their turns, and they were just amazing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we just talked to Lou Temple for about an hour there, and
oh, good.
Yeah, and I told him the same thing. One of my favorite all-time scenes, because he's another actor that I've just followed, and I don't know, there's just certain, like, you know, we do podcasting here, and we enjoy, you know, reviewing movies, and it just brings us so much joy. So to see two of your favorites have such a great exchange, and you guys have a great exchange like early on too, and I'm like, oh, this is a dream come true. So I just wanted to thank you for that, because I was like, this is great. And like I said too, I was so excited for this interview, because like we said, you've had so many roles over the years. Do you ever take a different approach depending on what the script is, or do you just normally approach everything about the same? Or
Well, the script is, you know, is this thing on which everything is based on whether I want it's a project that I really get excited about doing, and all of that's the number one decision maker, and if the script is good, you just use that as best you can. I didn't have anything. Any questions about this particular script? Mark had written so many of those Yankee Dog jokes, and unfortunately
the nun jokes.
He couldn't fit them all. This was disappointing because we had a great time doing them. But so he put one during the credits, which is one of my favorite things that he. He agreed. He decided. He didn't even tell me. I didn't know about it until I saw the screening.
No, it was funny. It was a high note way to end the film as well.
It really was. And
you just look so happy telling it too.
Yeah, like that was like the levity that you brought to this movie too. And this script really is smart too. And you said, you know, it's all about the script. I was just like, it just came to my mind just thinking about this. But I was like, I wonder what he thought when he read Hatchet. Because I'm a huge Adam Green fan too. Like I've had him on the show. Talked with him for hours. He's so great, and he's another one that we talked specifically about you for an extensive period of time. But I just like you're so diverse, and I think that with this latest movie, you know, first of all, we really did love it. You know, we watched it, and we really did. There's so many aspects to it. You know, like we said, the courtroom drama. Lacey mentioned it. You know, a play earlier. This is like a play. It's all in one room, and it's just so fun to watch. With this movie in particular, how do you think that mixing genres played into it? Because it's not a straight up horror movie.
It's not a straight up drama.
It's not a psychological. Do you think that's important though to label something like, oh, it has to be this? Or I think it speaks to it if it doesn't have a label.
Yeah, I think so too. I think the more open you are in terms of receiving it and of doing it, the better it is rather than just, you know, pigeonholing it in
right.
one particular time. But it does have all those elements. I mean, when they go off to do the backstory, you know, to tell Jimmy's story, it's really incredible. It's exciting. It's frightening. It's there's action and there's horror. There's blood and guts involved in it. And so when you see that, and then and then these people that it happened to come in and testify, it really becomes very interesting. You know, having somebody from the dead come back.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, and not only did we, like I said, enjoy just the story in itself, but man, like you mentioned earlier, the acting is just superb on all fronts. And, you know, it just shows you how much a movie depends on, you know, just the simple things, cinematography, acting. And like I said, with you guys in it, it just brought it to a different level, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like that emotional exchange that you mentioned earlier, you know, when you're talking about Disneyland. I just believe you in that moment.
Right.
Like, I believe that's what you hoped. Like, was that hard to do? Or, you know, it kind of, I don't know, like, it just gave me hope.
Yeah, right?
Well, you know, that was it. When he asks, what was it like, he has no sense of it because he's never been anywhere else but hell. He's a demon,
right?
And so, you know, when Jimmy says, you know, I hated Los Angeles, it's a dump, he says, oh, you know, how it disappoints me.
I said, what?
I know about these things, the sun coming up over the Temple Sang, or what, the
Great Wall of China.
Great Wall of China, yeah. And then, you know, and then there's the simple things like Disneyland, it's wonderful, you know, that he still holds that hope, even though he knows he's never gonna do anything else except sweep out the fire pit.
Right. Well, and I think, though, that exchange between those two characters, that's essential to Lou Temple's character's growth towards the end. You know, it's like you basically, as the story unfolds, you find out certain things and your perception of him changes, and it definitely leads towards the other way.
Is he good? Is he bad? Is there hope? Well,
right.
We'll find out if you watch it.
Exactly. Yeah, no, we...
I thought it was interesting, just along those lines, I hope I'm not getting it anyway, that you don't see what he did or didn't do.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right.
The redemption, that's based on.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's what I love about it. And you know, it's a lot of movies that are you know, smaller, like you said, in one room, and they're going for a certain thing. A lot of the times, that thing, while it's good, bad, or whatever, it just doesn't feel like a good payoff. With this, though, it didn't even feel like they were twists. It just felt like the plot, and it was really smart. Yeah, it came across as like, wow, like that was not only a fun experience, but I also feel like I've never seen anything like that. It was very unique.
It was unique.
It really was.
I absolutely agree that, you know, that the A story had nothing to do with
it. Right.
The reason behind it all, yeah.
Yeah. Well, but I do like how they kind of, you know, alluded to it throughout, though. There was certain dialogue that, you know, you could kind of catch on as to what was going to transpire later on in the film.
And I love that it was, you know, a very much character-driven plot.
Yes.
You know, there's so many different characters and their dynamics. And, you know, it's crazy because you think, like, you know, there's different mentions of, you know, of what's life after death. And, you know, you think when you die, like, that's just it. But no, like, now in this, they're fighting, you know, heaven and hell are fighting over souls. And it's so unique that it's in a courtroom setting.
Right.
What was it that you enjoyed most about doing this film?
Well, I loved telling the story. I mean, as Phil, as a stenographer, that's a big part of it. He's taken in, you know, and the story. It's the story. You know, he says, I really had a great time. I really like you people.
Aww.
I didn't want it to end. I'm having such a good time being involved in this, even as a recorder of what's happening. And, you know, and that's what I felt as an actor as well. I was having such a good time being part of this process. And like I say, watching these wonderful actors coming in and doing their turns, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Now, how long were you shooting in that room?
We were in that room for around 2 weeks, I believe.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. We would have, I'm trying to think, we usually had one person for the bigger scene. We had Peter Jacobson was 2 days shooting. Veronica Cartwright was 1 day shooting. James Purfoy was 2 days shooting. Rebecca Kennedy was 1 day shooting. But usually we didn't have, you know, we would do one witness and then whatever the stuff with the four of us in the room.
Right.
And get stuff. So we weren't able to go beginning to end in a normal fashion. We still had to, you know, go back and forth and pick up, or, you know, as filmmaking often happens. You know, the only time actually I ever did a film that shot beginning to end was The Fugitive.
Oh.
Because Harrison said, I don't want to keep having to change my makeup and hair and all that sort of stuff. But, and there's no reason to, because The Fugitive never goes back to any place that he was before. So Andy decided, he said, okay, let's shoot it right from beginning to end. That's what he did.
I love how he just does a reference and it's like The Fugitive. Like, even the solo references are just like instant classics. Sorry.
Right. We were actually talking about Harrison Ford earlier because we watched What Lies Beneath because today's its 20th anniversary.
Oh, yeah, it is.
All right.
So it's fun that you mentioned that. Before we wrap it up here, I always have to ask everybody, I'm sure you've probably been asked this question before, maybe not, I'm not sure, but what is your favorite horror movie?
Golly, yeah, that's a hard one, because it's funny, because I enjoyed watching horror films, but it wasn't a genre that I was particularly attracted to until Hatchet. And what happened with Hatchet is Joel David Moore, I had known from the time he was a student up in the Portland area, and when he came to LA, he contacted me and we were sort of in touch, and then he gave me a call and he said, look, I'm doing this horror film. I don't know if you'd even consider doing horror films, but I'm doing this horror film and they want somebody to play an older couple from the Midwest, and would you be interested in that? And I said, oh, you know, I've been waiting for someone to ask me to do a horror film. It's a genre that it's exciting to be a part of.
Yeah.
And I have to admit there are some horror films that they've kind of gotten to the point now where they become slasher, gory things. I don't enjoy that as much as the real suspense that type of horror films. I remember watching all of the Texas Chainsaw Massacres up to that time.
Yep.
Before we shot ours, and then reading about the shooting of the original one, and things like the fact that they had to be out of that house in 24 hours, and so they shot like for 24 hours straight with blackout curtains and everything in order to do it, and they were afraid that they would have a continuity problem, so they didn't change to change clothes or the food and some of the food at the table the last day they were shooting the dinner started exploding because it was going so bad.
Yep.
And all of those, or many of those people were in Texas Chainsaw 3D that I did. And we had like 4 days. We were all together, and I just pumped them for stories about what shooting that was like.
Yep.
I have to say that if you talk in terms of the whole Texas Chainsaw, the whole group of films, that'd probably be my favorite horror.
So I talked to Bill Moseley about this when I had him on. It was actually before the movie came out. And I'm dying to ask you because I'm trying to get some clarification on it. Now, the Texas Chainsaw timeline, in terms of how 3D fits in with it. Now, it's a sequel to the original, yet they have cell phones in it?
Yeah.
I love that movie, and honestly, I think it's so fun, it's great, and honestly, when you showed up and you were giving her the keys and everything, that was just so exciting, and I do love that movie. I just never understood. I'm like, wasn't this in the 70s, in the 60s? No, but it's honestly been such a pleasure watching you in everything that you've done, not only myself, but I know a lot of people that follow everything that you do, that love everything that you do, and you know, from our perspective, we do podcasting, we do film reviews and stuff like that, so to get the opportunity to interview somebody like yourself, who personally is one of my favorites, I am so happy right now.
Definitely a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
You are the best. This just made my year, honestly. This year had sucked, but this just made it.
Yes, he's... No, literally, every time you pop up, there's Richard! it's honestly a thing, so...
Yeah, man, you're the best.
So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate this.
We appreciate you, and we hope you have a good rest of your day.
Yes.
Well, thank you. You too.
Yes, stay safe.
You know, there are people in this world that don't have to put up with all this shit. Like that guy that invented the pet rock. You see, that's what you have to do. You have to use your mind and come up with some really great idea like that, and you can make millions, never have to work again.
You think the pet rock was a really great idea?
Sure it was. The guy made $1 million. You know, I had an idea like that once, a long time ago.
Really? What was it, Tom?
Well, all right. It was a jump to conclusions mat. You see, it would be this mat that you would put on the floor and would have different conclusions written on it that you could jump to.
It feels good to be a gangster. A real gangster-ass nigga plays his cards right. A real gangster-ass nigga never runs his fucking mouth, cause real gangster-ass niggas don't start fights. And niggas always got a hot cap, showing all his boys how he shot them. But real gangster-ass niggas don't flex nuts, cause real gangster-ass niggas know they got them. And everything's cool in the mind of a gangster, cause gangster-ass niggas think deep. Up 365, ayo, 24/7, cause real gangsta ass niggas don't sleep. And all I gotta say to you wannabe cocksucker pussy pranksters is when the fire dies down, what the fuck you gonna do? Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
Gangster, feeding the poor and helping out with their bills. Although I was born in Jamaica, now I'm in the US making deals. Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. I mean, one that you don't really know. Riding around town in a drop top Benz, hitting switches in my black 6-4. Now gangster ass niggas come in all shapes and colors. Some got killed in the past, but this gangster here was a smart one. Started living for the Lord and I last. Now all I gotta say to you, wanna be, gonna be pussy and cocksucking pranksters. When the shit jumps off, what the fuck you gonna do? Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
To be a gangster, a real gangster ass nigga knows the play. The real gangster ass niggas get the flies of the bitches. Ask that gangster ass nigga little chick. The bitches look at gangster ass niggas like a stop sign and play the role of Little Miss Sweet. But catch the bitch all alone, get the digits, take her out and end up hitting her ass with the meat. Cause gangster ass niggas be the game players and everything's quiet in the clique. A gangsta-ass nigga pulls the trigger and his partner's in the posse ain't telling off shit. Real gangsta-ass niggas don't talk much. All you hear is the black from the gun blast. And real gangsta-ass niggas don't run for shit. It's real gangsta-ass niggas can't run fast. Now when you in the free world talking shit, you the shit. Hit the pin and let a motherfucker shank you. But niggas like myself kick back and peep game. Cause damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world, but the Market family is my boss. So every now and then I hold a favor here and there, like letting a big drug shipment through and send them to the poor community so we can bust you know who. The voters of the world keep supporting me, and I promise to take you very far. Other leaders better not upset me, or I'll send a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me to win, I sincerely like to thank you, cause now I got the world swinging from my nuts, and damn it feels good to be a gangster.